Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Honestly, Fraser, you must be the last psychiatrist on Earth who hasn't abandoned Sigmund Freud's theories.
What are you saying?
Merely that his theories are outdated, sexist superstitions unsupported by a shred of clinical evidence.
You're drunk.
Freud may have laid the groundwork for science of the unconscious, but didn't he get most of it wrong?
Today's picture of the unconscious is a lot more scientific than Freud's, but it isn't perfect.
What would Freud say about a bunch of philosophers questioning everything except the unconscious?
I had a semester and a half of college, so I understand Freud.
Does that make me crazy? Does that make me crazy?
What Freud showed us is the sort of deep lack of access that we have to our unconscious mind.
Our guest is Blakey Vermeule, author of The New Unconscious, A Literary Guided Tour.
What has replaced Freud?
Well, what would Freud say?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk. What's the latest wisdom about the unconscious mind?
Can modern scientists do better than Freud?
Could anyone do worse?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from our respective living rooms via the studios of KALW San Francisco.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, what has replaced Freud?
You know, Ray, I'm not a huge fan of Freud, and I think it's a good thing he's being replaced. But I will give him one thing. He did popularize the idea that we don't always know why we do the things we do.
Right. He didn't invent the idea of the unconscious, by the way, which has actually been around for millennia. Like the ancient Epicurean philosopher Lucretius, he talked about how we have an unconscious fear of death that motivates us to act in irrational ways.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Freud's contribution was to bring these ideas more into mainstream consciousness, no pun intended. Nowadays, pretty much everyone's familiar with the idea that there's a lot we don't know about ourselves.
Well, I would actually give Freud a little more credit than that. It's not just that now everyone knows about unconscious beliefs and desires and all that stuff, but those ideas gained a new kind of scientific respectability because of him.
Scientific what?
Well, respectability. What's your problem?
The idea that boys all want to kill their fathers and sleep with their mothers. Women all wish they had male genitalia and envy men for that. These aren't exactly scientific. I mean, there isn't a shred of evidence for half of what Freud says. And that's precisely why he's fallen out of favor.
Yeah, okay. I'm not going to argue with you on the Oedipus complex. But no science is static. I mean, biologists used to think that maggots appeared spontaneously out of rotting food, and now we know the flies lay eggs. Look, science evolves, Josh.
Yeah, sure, okay, for maggots, but I mean, Freud? Freud's claims were never scientific in the first place, because he didn't follow the scientific method. And if you don't follow that method, you're not doing science.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I would also add that your findings have to be replicable.
How do you mean?
So let's say you're conducting an experiment to see how people's judgments are influenced by factors they're not aware of. And say you get a certain result, like that holding up a warm cup of coffee leads people to develop positive opinions about strangers, and holding a cold drink leads them to develop negative opinions.
Okay, yeah, this sounds like that famous experiment by the psychologist John Barg.
So now let's say other scientists try to replicate this experiment, but they never get the same result as you.
Yeah, that would be a big problem.
Right, and you would question the legitimacy of the original experiment. You would doubt that there was any real effect ever discovered.
Yeah, okay, look, I see your point, and I'm just as eager to ditch the results of those bad experiments as I am to ditch Freud. But come on, I mean, with Freud, it's even worse. He didn't conduct experiments like that at all, so there's nothing even to try to replicate. At least some of today's science is going to hold up.
You're in denial.
Oh, nice one, Sigmund.
Look, I see a ton of psychological experiments that fail to replicate. Come on, they're even calling it a replication crisis. Freud's theories were unscientific, but what replaced Freud? It's not doing a whole lot better. And I bet our guest today, Stanford professor Blakey Vermeule, is going to agree with me.
She's great. I'm super looking forward to this. And, you know, I got to say, this kind of skepticism is very healthy. In fact, I wish people had more skepticism when it came to Freud. But still, Ray, I don't know. I feel like there are lots and lots of results from today's science that do replicate. And you know what? They're pretty cool.
Well, cool or not, they can be dangerous if you take them too far. Like, what happens if your psychologist thinks you're full of repressed memories, but you really aren't? And what if those memories are of really bad stuff, like child abuse? What if innocent people are prosecuted because of those fake memories?
Or what if guilty people are exonerated because of doubts about memory? We sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDee, to find out more. And just a quick warning, Holly's report does contain references to sexual abuse and acquaintance murder, so listener discretion is advised.
The idea that memories can be repressed has been around since Freud first proposed that painful memories are often buried deep in the unconscious. But a recent effort to cast doubt on repressed memories began a few decades ago. In 1990, a researcher named Elizabeth Loftus got a call from a lawyer defending a man named George Franklin. His daughter had accused him of murdering her best friend decades earlier after apparently recovering memories of the crime during therapy.
The only evidence against him was the testimony of his daughter, who said that she had witnessed this murder when she was 8 years old and that she repressed her memory for 20 years and now the memory was back.
Franklin was convicted and spent 5 years in jail before doubts over his daughter's testimony were raised and his conviction was overturned. Loftus has continued to study how memories can be unreliable. She's testified in sexual misconduct and murder cases involving defendants like Ted Bundy and O.J. Simpson. During the trial against Harvey Weinstein, Loftus testified that leading questions by investigators and extensive media coverage can contaminate and alter memories.
Without independent corroboration that can confirm the memory or exonerate it, you can't know for sure whether somebody's report is true or false. But there are often people, on the other side of the case who, in so many words, effectively insist that the memory is real.
The idea that memories can be false is often used to discredit victims. After Christine Blasey Ford testified against then-Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh, her memory was also questioned. And some speculated she may have confused Kavanaugh with someone else.
How are you so sure that it was he?
The same way that I'm sure that I'm talking to you right now. It's just basic memory functions and just the level of norepinephrine and epinephrine in the brain that sort of that neurotransmitter encodes memories into the hippocampus. And so the trauma-related experience then is kind of locked there, whereas other details kind of drift.
You can trace some of that discourse around repressed memories to two parents, Pam and Peter Fried. In the 90s, their daughter Jennifer privately accused her father of sexually abusing her. Jennifer has said that memories of abuse resurfaced after speaking with a therapist.
Her parents turned what was a private family issue into the most extreme public one imaginable.
Warwick Middleton is one of Jennifer's good friends and a professor at the University of Queensland. He says Jennifer is now one of the most famous psychotherapy patients in human history. Her parents, both academics, denied the allegations and responded by forming an organization called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation.
And then pursuing a political agenda whereby they sent out newsletters but also sort of took in accused parents, which is what Pamela and Peter Fried portrayed themselves as being, falsely accused parents, with the accusation being that the daughter's therapist has somehow implanted false memories into her mind.
Middleton says the discussion around memories at the time led to extremes. On the one side, some people thought that we've all been abused but don't know it. On the other side, people thought that there were out-of-control therapists creating false memories everywhere.
The impetus of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation position was that, you know, the general populace went from believing victims' accounts of abuse to focusing on falsely accused parents. And yes, undoubtedly, amidst the confusion of it all, there were some people falsely accused, as there's always been. There are also many people who were abusers who, you know, shielded under the threat of prosecution by invoking a false memory defense.
Laura Brown is a psychologist who specializes in trauma. And she says the ideas of the False Memory Syndrome Foundation worked their way into intro psych textbooks.
I used to teach a class for first-year medical students about the medical and psychosocial consequences of childhood sexual abuse. And inevitably, someone would say, but what about false memories?
She says the bottom line is this. It's possible for people to develop false beliefs about things that happen in their lives. and people can also have things happen in their lives that are confusing, painful, hard to understand, and therefore difficult to recall.
Until something made it necessary for them to recall. And both of those things are true.
The False Memory Syndrome Foundation quietly folded in 2019, but there is still a lot we don't understand about the nature of memory. In sexual abuse cases, there is rarely physical evidence, documentation, or witnesses. But there are infinite opportunities for doubt, and memories are an easy target. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly J. McDeed.
Thanks for that fascinating and complex report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're thinking about what has replaced Freud.
We're joined now by Blicky Vermeule, who's a professor of English at Stanford University and the author of The New Unconscious, a literary guided tour in the Oxford Handbook of Cognitive Literary Studies. Blicky, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thank you, Ray. It's nice to be here.
So, Blicky, you're a literature professor and one of the best I know, but these days you're writing about the unconscious mind. So how did that happen? How did you get interested in that?
Well, I studied Freud as an undergraduate, and then I went to graduate school, and I worked with a professor named Frederick Cruz, who is probably the most closely associated with bringing Freud's legacy into disrepute. I was absolutely rooting for Fred as he was writing his papers in the New York Review of Books, and I've since come to think that we have made a terrible, terrible mistake in ditching the Freudian framework.
Can you tell us more about why we ditched, or why you thought we should ditch, the Freudian framework?
Well, the Freudian framework is just insane. It makes absolutely no sense from beginning to end. It was something that was sort of created out of whole cloth by a person with a profound hero complex and a desire to be the head of a kind of religious movement, and he succeeded in a way beyond his wildest dreams. And his influence really kind of lasted up until about the 1970s, when in fact many medical schools had entire curricula devoted to psychoanalysis, and then it just collapsed. The whole sort of legacy more or less collapsed in a way over the course of a single decade, the 1980s and early 90s.
So if he was so unscientific, why was it a mistake to ditch his theories? It sounds like a good thing.
Well, because I think that what Freud showed us is the sort of deep lack of access that we have to our unconscious mind. And that was a very, very powerful, indeed necessary intervention. But more than that, his framework was fundamentally pessimistic. It was fundamentally drawn from the world of Schopenhauer. What has replaced him has a totally different framework. And I think that that's something worth exploring.
Okay, that second part makes sense. The first part, though, I don't know. Precisely because people like Schopenhauer were on the scene, and Nietzsche, and this guy Hartmann, who wrote the whole book, The Philosophy of the Unconscious.
Right.
I mean, it's not like he really invented it. Freud had it said that line at one point, to most people who've been educated in philosophy, the idea of anything psychical, which is not also conscious, is inconceivable. That was never true. It was a good sales pitch. But is it really the case that we needed Freud in order to tell people that there are things, there are motivating forces that drive us that we're not aware of and things like that?
Well, whether we needed him or not, that was how the information spread, was through his influence. And his influence was profound on popular culture, on academia, on science, on the practice of psychoanalysis. And so there was a kind of brief moment, or brief maybe a five-decade moment in the 20th century, when people really deeply understood the forces of irrational human behavior.
I'm a little bit surprised that you think we've thrown out Freud's idea of the unconscious as well, because it seems like now lots of people still believe, and did believe before Freud, that lots of what's going on in our minds isn't consciously accessible. Is that part of the baby that's gotten thrown out with the bathwater, or not really?
I think that it's hard for us to accept the degree to which our conscious reasoning is just this kind of puny little, I mean, there are different metaphors in circulation, but I think my favorite one is that it's like a snowflake on top of an iceberg, basically. And the reason that it seems to kind of exist is to give us a kind of after the fact sense of a plausible narrative, and also to justify the kinds of things we are likely to want to do in any case.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're asking what has replaced Freud with Blakey Vermeule from Stanford University.
If you don't know what you're thinking, who does? Is science any better than psychoanalysis? How can we tell which theories will stand the test of time?
Consciousness, complexes, and cognitive biases, along with your comments and questions when Philosophy Talk continues.
I got two. And you know, two heads are better than one.
Freud had some crazy ideas. Not sure he ever suggested getting a second head, though. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're thinking about The Unconscious After Freud with Blakey Vermeule from Stanford University, author of The New Unconscious, a literary guided tour.
We're definitely conscious of the ongoing pandemic, so we're pre-recording this episode from the safety of our respective homes, and unfortunately can't take your phone calls. But you can always email us at comments@philosophytalk.org, or you can comment on our website, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Blakey, we're going to start this segment with an email from a listener. This comes from Kirk in East Lansing, Michigan, who says, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky's research into biases, contextual influences affecting rationality, and failures in reasoning has replaced the model of the unconscious mind, but not necessarily the idea of unacknowledged forces acting on thinking and influencing desires. So what's that about, Blakey? Who are Kahneman and Tversky?
Well, Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky are two of the most famous psychologists of the 20th century, and they more or less developed the experimental framework that has set our understanding of the unconscious. They began working together in 1969, I believe, or 1970. Their collaboration produced a whole series of papers for which ultimately Daniel Kahneman won the Nobel Prize in 2002. Tversky would have also shared in the Nobel Prize, except he had unfortunately died of cancer. So I would say that they're the most influential psychologists of the latter part of the 20th century.
And so Kirk says they believe in unacknowledged forces that act on thinking and influence desires. What kinds of unacknowledged forces?
Well, in a nutshell, their contribution to the sort of psychological literature is the idea of the dual process brain. And that has now become sort of the standard view of how the mind works, that there are two systems in the brain. One is called system one, and the other one is system two. So system one is automatic, it's efficient, it's fast, it's immediate, it's easy. We can easily sort of recall things in system one. And system two, that which we would call sort of consciousness, is controlled. It's flexible, it's slow, and most importantly, it's effortful. So that's the kind of key insight that they had, is that system two, what we call rationality or consciousness, is actually difficult for people, and that most people are, as Kahneman put it repeatedly in his writings, are lazy, and they don't want to have to think too hard.
So that sounds to me like a somewhat pessimistic framework, right? I mean, they're famous for introducing, they and others, I guess, famous for introducing things like the idea of the confirmation bias, right, where we're constantly attending to things that confirm our pre-existing opinions, or like the idea of cognitive dissonance, we hate to feel like we were wrong or stupid, or, you know, the anchoring heuristic, where you start with a number and everything looks good or bad. Like, you know, Donald Trump saying 2 million COVID deaths, it was going to look good by contrast to that, whatever happened, you know. So isn't this a somewhat pessimistic framework, that human beings are so susceptible to these cognitive biases, these things that kind of bypass our a reason and make us make mistakes all the time?
Well, I think that's a good point, Josh. And to be fair to both Kahneman and Tversky, they never in any sense put a kind of moral or cultural framework around their work. In fact, if you go back and reread it, as I do from time to time, what strikes you over and over again, or what strikes me over and over again, is how really sweet and innocent it is. I mean, they're just sort of trying to figure stuff out about how people reason, and it's wonderful. I think the disaster for this way of thinking was that it was more or less taken up by capitalism, or by the sort of financial industry, by business schools, by hedge funds, by corporations, as a way to try to get people to behave more or less rationally. And that, to my mind, has been just disastrous.
Yes. Yeah, so what's wrong with behaving rationally? Isn't that something that we should all want to do?
Sure, we should, except that I think that let me put it this way, that a lot of this work, so there's certain names before and after Kahneman and Tversky. So in the late 20th century, the more famous, the most famous psychology experiments, they started off with the Ash conformity experiments. Then there were the Milgram experiments. Then there was the work by Richard Nisbet and Timothy Wilson on consumer choice. And then came Kahneman and Tversky, and they really sort of blew this whole field apart. And then came Richard Thaler and Cass Sunstein, and they were the two who more or less tried to popularize behavioral economics, behavioral psychology, prospect theory, and they made it a question of sort of policy. And so in the 90s, as I'm sure you remember, and the 2000s, a lot of sort of governments across the globe developed nudge units. Obama's famously did. The British government has a nudge unit to this day, in which they try to put in place incentives to get people to behave better or more rationally or more in keeping with their long-term interests.
So it seems like trying to get people to behave rationally is kind of separable into two parts, that I want to understand those two separately. So one is the idea of trying to get people to behave in a way, which lots of entities do, like corporations do that every time they advertise something to you. And you might think, like, that's slimy, but you can either do it well or badly depending on how well you achieve your goal. Like, so if you have a theory that works, you could use it to slimy ends, but it could still be a true theory that, like, correctly predicts stuff. And then there's this other thing about, like, what is in their best interest or rational for them to do, which seems like a value judgment that you might want to let them in on. So is your worry about, like, one part or both part of that?
My worry is about the more or less the consumer framework that has underlined this whole, what we might call the sort of popularization of this entire realm of research. So the people who have made it popular are Malcolm Gladwell, most famously in his book Blink. He was the person who sort of more or less popularized the Kahneman-Tversky view. But the message that has gotten out there has been relentlessly kind of solutionist and optimistic. And it's about, you know, perfecting, constantly sort of perfecting your life and trying to, you know, be better at things like self-care or to be better at things like just, you know, little nudges and fixes that might or might not make you into a better sort of subject of the bourgeois capitalist experience. But at the same time, while all of this has been going on, there's been a kind of brewing economic and social disaster starting in the 1970s because of the very same kind of, call it neoliberal framework that has been producing these nudge units. So I guess that's more or less my view, is that we've been paying attention to the kind of moving tiny little pieces around the board, while at the same time missing a kind of deeper disaster. And that's where I think more or less a Freudian worldview would actually be useful.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about the unconscious after Freud with Blakey Vermeule from Stanford University. So, gosh, there's so much here, Blakey. I love what you're saying. I personally think we can have our pessimism without resorting to Freud. I mean, it's like you build a castle, you learn from Monty Python. If you build a castle in the swamp, it's going to sink into the swamp. Like, let's build on different foundations. We could start back with Schopenhauer, or we could start with Nietzsche, or Adorno, or some. There's lots of great pessimists, including Milgram. So you mentioned Stanley Milgram. I mean, those experiments are very pessimistic. I mean, they seem to show that people would, or regular folks would, torment other people if they were told to. And so do we really need to return to Freud just to get our pessimism back?
That's a great question, Josh. Okay, so maybe a more substantive way of putting this is that yes, that Freud gave us a kind of mad sort of pessimistic framework, but he also gave us a sense. I mean, more or less the non-scientific writers before him who were talking about or thinking about the unconscious, he was drawing on a realm of mythology or of sort of shared human storytelling. And one of the things that I believe very much that has gone away, apparently, in the sort of post-Freudian collapse, has been any sense of shared mythology, shared kind of shared register of, meaning making. Nudge units definitely don't give us a sense of meaning. They don't give us a sense of a sort of wider framework of human endeavor that the unconscious seems to be sort of part of or tapping into. And to me, that has been a tragedy.
That makes sense to me. And, the thing I always say to staunch Freudians when they make that argument is Scientology does too. Let's choose a meaning-making framework that we believe. But I want to come back to this idea of nudges. And I mean, I really like your thought that there's a kind of a negative side to them. But, I'll play angel's advocate here on behalf of the nudges. Like, think about, cases where there's always going to be some default. Like, for example, you sign up for some service, and the default setting is you've opted into their mailing list, which kind of sucks, right? Maybe it'd be better if the default setting is you opt out, and then you're forced to opt in if you want to. So why not think that there are cases like that where it's actually in our own interest? It's just benevolent. It's like, that's very nice of you. Look, there has to be some default. You can't set up a system with no default. So let's think together about what the best default is for the average human being and go with that. What's wrong with that?
Well, I have a one-word answer for you, Josh, two-word answer, and that's Donald Trump. I mean, you can set up all the defaults you want in your nice little kind of rational system, and lo and behold, here comes the jack in the box.
Actually, I want to push on this too, not because I like Donald Trump, obviously, but because I'm not sure that like the theory of like behavioral economics and nudges is really to blame. So it seems factually true to me that little differences in people's environments will affect how they behave. And like, you can either ignore that or kind of try to act on it. And in fact, it seems like a lot of the way that the Twitter environment is set up, it causes people to do nasty things on Twitter, like, trumpet misinformation or harass each other. And that maybe a different environment would produce different results. So I guess, like, is it the observations of behavioral economics that are wrong? Are they reporting falsehoods, or are they reporting truths that are somehow like distracting us from considering other truths, or are they reporting truths that enable them to like manipulate others in harmful ways, even though you need a true theory to do that?
Yeah, I guess I think that's a good question. So I look back at the history of social psychological experimentation in the 20th century, which is it's a fascinating sort of field, and it's worth trying to study and understand the kind of sweep of it. But some of the first social psychological experiments, like the ones that were done by Nisbet and Wilson in Michigan in the 1970s, And then the whole tradition that they inaugurated were largely about tricking people, about fooling people into basically being dupes for this sort of experimental situation. So the most, you know, there are a couple sort of famous examples. One of them, maybe the best one to talk about, is the Xerox experiments that were done by Ellen Langer at NYU or at CUNY and then at Harvard in the 70s. And they were basically, you know, as follows. So suppose you have some Xeroxes that you have to make. You go up to somebody at the Xerox machine, you say, can I make some Xeroxes? Can I cut in front of you and make some Xeroxes? They're going to say no. If you say, I want to cut in front of you because I need to make some Xeroxes, then the chance of their sort of, you know, acceptance rate is going to go way up. That's just a sort of small example of how adding a kind of level of causality or explanation is going to induce people, influence people to do what you want them to do.
That's great. Blakey, we have an email from Carl in Portland, Oregon. Carl says, this conscious versus subconscious mind distinction is BS. Certainly a great many of our mental functions are executed necessarily with no or marginal awareness, and surely our frontiers of awareness can expand volitionally to some degree. But it's clear that such a maneuver would not necessarily be to human advantage. So isn't the real query one concerning the dimensions and degrees of awareness we choose to seek?
Right. So there are certain aspects of our brain that we simply can't have access to through introspection, right? So color detection, there would be absolutely no advantage to us to having a sense of, you know, how we go about detecting colors or edges. But there are plenty of aspects of our unknown mind that we do have, or we can have introspective access to, or more specifically access because other people have shown us that we're slipping on a kind of banana peel. And that's maybe what Freud called the subconscious. That's the stuff that's actually very interesting to social psychology, not the edge detection.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about what has replaced Freud with Blakey Vermeule, professor of English at Stanford University.
Will we ever solve the replication crisis? Are today's social scientists making the same mistakes as Freud? What will our picture of the mind look like tomorrow?
Freeing ourselves from Freud, plus a conundrum about nature's design from one of our listeners, when Philosophy Talk continues. Doesn't love someone for psychological reasons. Is that what Freud figured out? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Accept your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Blakey Vermeule from Stanford University, and we're thinking about the unconscious after Freud.
So Blakey, what if we made you dean of all research and experimental psychology? What would be the first thing you'd change?
The first thing I'd change is to really try to give full shrift understanding to the fact that people have very, very strong need for transcendence, intuitions for transcendence, that treating them as sort of consumers who are able to kind of choose between tiny little different choices is actually really pretty profoundly undervaluing our needs. That's the first thing that I would do, is take people's need for transcendence seriously.
So, Blakey, you've mentioned transcendence now and a couple of earlier times, storytelling. And I'm wondering, like, where we might look for sources of those things apart from Freud. And I thought, like, there are actually a lot of places we could choose from. So I think the entire field of literature is kind of about trying to make meaning from our lives in a human rather than a, like, objective way, isn't it?
It is, I guess. So to come back to the example that I was going to avoid earlier, Josh and I have a long-standing interest in mafia movies.
Yes.
And one of my sort of little pet theories about our current moment is that The Godfather and The Sopranos and so forth, Breaking Bad, more or less made a certain kind of style of mob boss actually appear kind of friendly and palatable and delightful. So when that mob boss kind of came along, people were more or less prepared to find that style acceptable. To me, that's an example of ignoring more or less the kind of mythic structure of people's psychic life, which I think that the current kind of psychological establishment really, really does.
Yeah, let's look to Jung. Let's look to Nietzsche. I mean, of course, as a culture of a long history of thinking about, I mean, Pascal, you know, the heart has reasons of which reason knows nothing. Let's reread all of these folks. I agree with you. Let's think hard about what the deepest needs of human beings are, whether they're being met and how to meet them better.
I'm kind of wondering about exactly how we situate meaning. So one approach you could have is that like a good approach to psychology should give humans meanings, but I'm not really convinced by that, because I think like lots of religions provide meanings and they're bad meanings that harm people, and those mafia movies provide like harmful meanings. But it sounded like one of the points you were making with that example, and like correct me if I'm wrong, is that we got to understand how humans make meanings in a way that doesn't just treat them as little mechanistic objects in order to accurately predict what they're going to do in like large scenarios, not just small ones. Is that a good way of saying what's going on?
Yeah, I think maybe so I guess the way I would put it is that humans do make meanings. We have a tremendous need to make meaning, and we're going to do that whether or not we're being sort of nudged into behaving sort of more rationally for our own long-term interest or not. I think the sort of QAnon conspiracy theory is a perfect case in point. It's a collective example of storytelling where people are sort of desperate to try to impose some order on a disorderly world. We're still doing that. We're making meaning. It's just that we're doing it outside of these kind of narrow little bands of what contemporary mind science considers the realm of experimental understanding.
Okay, so this may sound too kumbaya, but I'm wondering if we can't sort of reach a kind of peace accord here where you could have a bit of both, because, very often when you ask these folks, tell us a little bit about transcendence, they won't say to you, it's not a real need. They might just say, we're not sure about that. So I'm wondering if the things can't be compatible like this. I find a lot of stuff really exciting about the new psychology. For example, I think it's leading to better forms of treatment. For patients with certain conditions, really, I think, powerful coping strategies for folks in need, you know, helping us protect ourselves against fraudsters, because fraudsters are using or exploiting our cognitive biases, you know. I kind of like the way that, unlike the Freudian view, it isn't the hermeneutics of suspicion, right? It doesn't assume that all unconscious processes are antisocial and the sickest motivation is the truest and everything genuine is. So couldn't we have a little bit of both? Like, couldn't we bring back, just as you want, I think very powerfully you're urging us to do, a sense of the pessimism, the tragic side of life, the dangers, the deep human needs, but also keep some of these findings in place?
Yes. And maybe here's what's actually motivating my interest in this. Humanists have been completely swept aside in this conversation since the 1970s. I mean, there's now a large kind of set of tree branches which stretch across the academic world, from business schools to psych departments to, you know, neuromarketing schools to nudge units to corporations. And there's one group of people, namely humanists and philosophers, if I may say, who have been almost entirely left out of the conversation. And that's kind of the point. In a way, I watched it happen in the 80s when the new psychologists were fighting the Freudians. But this whole new way of thinking has left behind not only the tragic sense of life, which I think we need to, you know, bring back, but also the humanities, also storytelling and meaning making. So I think that that's my objection to it.
Right. So I have a question about like where we fit. A lot of the studies that you cited sort of leading up to and following on from Kahneman and Tversky were experiments where you just put people in a like little lab situation and manipulate their behavior. And it seems to me like there are some things about human beings that you can find out that way. And there are an awful lot of things about human beings that you can't find out that way, because there are aspects of them that you either can't or shouldn't manipulate in a lab. And like, I don't know, maybe some of it, like the Milgram experiment involves manipulating things that you shouldn't manipulate in a lab. Like, is that where the humanities fit in?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And it's also the case that so many of these psych experiments have been, as it turns out, done on American and European college students. So they're within a kind of framework, which is now called the WEIRD framework. And maybe you've heard this acronym. Yeah. It means
it's Western Educated Industrial
Rich. Democratic. But essentially the upshot of this is individualism. And a kind of extreme psychological extreme of individualism.
Yeah, and I'm excited by more recent developments where they're starting to question that and to run these experiments in different parts of the world, for example.
Right. So it turns out that the Ash conformity experiments were outliers in the sense of not conforming with the Ash conformity experiments, but the Milgram experiments seem to replicate very well, which is a little terrifying.
Oh, that is indeed disturbing.
Yeah.
Well, Blakey, this is a demoralizing, but I think also very powerful place to stop, especially with your pitch for the necessity of storytelling in the humanities, which I share completely. And, you know, given the pecan bias, you know what that means? It means it's been a great conversation. So thank you so much for joining us today.
Good. Thank you, Josh. And thank you, Ray.
Our guest has been Blakey Vermeule, professor of English at Stanford University and author of The New Unconscious, A Literary Guided Tour in the Oxford Handbook of Cognitive Literary Studies. So, Ray, what are you thinking now? Do we need to ask your therapist?
No, I think I can introspect pretty adequately. I've been thinking about two books on the human mind that I've been reading and enjoying that are pretty different. So the first is this 1985 book by Oliver Sacks called The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, which is basically a series of case studies of people with strange things happening to their minds that can be explained by their neurology. So I think that this is a really good set of cases for the experimental approaches that Blakey talks about. So, you know, somebody who is a painter and then has a nerve injury that prevents them from being able to see color at all in sort of ways that don't function like usual color blindness. And the explanation for this is kind of internal to them and their brain, and it admits a scientific explanation and they still have to deal with it. So there are those kinds of examples. And the other book that I've been really enjoying is a really different book called Trauma and Recovery, which is a 1992 book by Judith Herman, which I believe introduced the idea of PTSD. And that book takes a very different approach that's a sort of like cross-cultural observation approach to trauma. So she connects actually some of Freud's early work on trauma in his patients, which he kind of later repudiated, and stories about shell-shocked soldiers, and shows how like these people's narratives about their experience reflect a lot of common points. And so that's a really narrative approach. And I thought it was really cool that both of these books seemed valuable to me in different ways.
That's fantastic, Ray. I also recommend our own Jennifer Eberhard on implicit bias, and our philosophy talk regulars, Allison Gopnik, Paul Bloom, and David Eagleman. We'll put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
Now, let's check in with a listener looking for a little philosophical advice. It's time for a conundrum. Diane, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Oh, thanks very much.
Where are you calling from, Diane?
Portland, Oregon.
And what's your conundrum for us today?
We have two cats. One of the cats sits in the sun and doesn't bother anybody, and the other cat is a huntress. We have to keep her in so she doesn't kill birds. If we know coyotes or bobcats are in the neighborhood, we have to keep both cats in so they don't get eaten by something else. We have insects that prowl around in the kitchen and are an annoyance, But I say to them aloud, you can bother me when I'm interred, when I'm in the ground, you can eat me up, but don't bother me now. And, you know, we have this virus that everybody's cowering in front of, that just wants to use us as a place to replicate more efficiently. Everything in the world, every animate thing in the world, from a virus to a bobcat and beyond, is out to eat everything else or prevent itself from being eaten for a while. It seems to me, when I think about it, like a crazy way to organize a planet. And I've got to believe that there are science fiction writers who have taken this on.
One science fiction writer I know who has taken up this issue is Ursula Le Guin.
I thought Ursula Le Guin and Marge Piercy was another one.
Yes, actually. And so Ursula Le Guin has this great story, The Ones Who Walk Away from the Omelas. Oh. And one kind of cool thing that I learned recently about the story is that N.K. Jemisin now has a story that's kind of a reply to it called The Ones Who Stay and Fight, where she kind of challenges Ursula Le Guin's premise in writing this story. So Le Guin is kind of grappling with the idea that in order to live in a civilized society, maybe you need to do some terrible evil to somebody. And sort of then just describes like people faced with this choice and what they do. And N.K. Jemisin says, why did you set the choice up that way, basically? So that's kind of what that essay is about.
Here's a question I have for you, Diane. No. Have you considered the Gnostics? You know, my grandma always used to say to me, look at the beautiful world, the way it's set up. You know, every creature finds another creature to eat and every, you know, it must be a god. And I would say, yeah, you know, look at the emerald cockroach wasp. You know, that's the one that like hijacks the brain of a cockroach, drives it around like a tank, lays its eggs and it eats it alive. I mean, it's like a horror movie. There's just death going on in the natural world. There's like torture on an unimaginable scale. So here's my thought. What if the Gnostics are right and there is a creator, but the creator isn't benevolent? Maybe there's a benevolent super being somewhere out there, but that being isn't in charge of our world. Our world was created and is ruled by someone who's either incompetent or malevolent or indifferent or some combination. What do you think about that?
I think there's a counter argument from religious sources that we need baser instincts in our composition to rise above, to propel us to become more in the image of God.
Yeah, I'm a little skeptical, actually, of the idea that that we need sort of evil and base instincts to rise above. Like this is a kind of common response to the problem of evil. I'm not sure I buy that we need the amount of evil that's in the world to make us good people. There's like, do human beings really need to like commit genocide and child abuse so that we can pass some kind of moral test? That seems excessive.
Of course, one of my favorite lines is Schopenhauer's line, where there is a reason for all this suffering and cruelty in the world of animals, including human animals, and that's to show us how terrible everything is. Which in turn, hopefully, he thinks, should cause us to stop desiring and kind of get off that treadmill and ultimately bring everything to an end.
How many illegitimate children did he father? You know,
well, most of that's a decisive argument against him. Nietzsche thought he's playing the flute was a good argument against him too, but.
Yeah, I'm not sure that we should think that the universe is the way it is to teach us a lesson. Number one, because why should we be the center of it? Like, why should the universe care whether we are happy or sad? And number two, if I were designing a lesson plan, I don't think I'd give myself very high marks for the world as it exists if my learning objective were that my students learn to be nice to each other.
Yeah, I mean, I love that point. But just to say one thing in defense of Schopenhauer, it's not for our benefit that the world teaches us a lesson. It's for its own. It's this elaborate sort of suicide by cop plan on the part of the universe, right? That it wants to come to an end and it needs us to kind of do a little bit of work and then poof, everything vanishes. And that's ultimately.
That is my conundrum in a nutshell is, what is the advantage to nature that it is red in tooth and claw? What does nature get out of that, or the creator, or however you view this?
Well, that is a fantastic conundrum. I'm delighted that we haven't answered it, because I think it's a great thing to keep thinking about for a very long time. I'm so grateful to you for having raised it for us today, Diane.
Oh, thank you.
If you've got a conundrum that's got you in a bind, a dilemma in your personal life that might benefit from some philosophical insight, send it to us at conundrums@philosophytalk.org, and maybe we can think through it together.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco and the trustees of Leland Stanford Jr. University. Copyright 2021.
Our executive producer is Tina Pamintuan.
The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research. And Cindy Prince-Baum is our director of marketing.
Thanks also to Merle Kessler and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
The views expressed, or misexpressed, on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can subscribe to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.